Yeah, let's start with 308. And Mr. French, you're back again. So why don't you come up and tell us about 308?
I have some written testimony from the District Attorney's Association.
All right.
Forward to you. For the record, my name is Alvin French. I'm representing the Oregon District Attorney's Association this morning, and I'm a senior deputy district attorney in Clackamas County. Senate Bill 308 essentially does two things. It amends two bills that are both address the identity theft problem, which is, I'm sure all of you know, an extremely big problem in the state and in the country. The first part of it addresses the criminal discovery statutes. And for those of you not familiar with criminal law, prosecutors are required to provide discovery to the defendants in all criminal cases, and that usually is police reports, but also includes other documents, documentary evidence that the state has in its possession and could use at trial. And frequently that information includes financial information, particularly if the case we're prosecuting is a fraud case or a forgery case, something like that. And a personal financial information would certainly include dates of birth of people, but frequently include things like driver's license numbers, bank account numbers, social security numbers, credit card numbers. The first part of the statute would limit the distribution, the first part of this bill would limit the distribution of this personal financial information to the defendant himself. It would go to his attorney, but it would not go to the defendant. Under the present statute, there are similar provisions for not giving the address and the telephone number of victims to the defendants, and this would just expand that slightly to include the personal financial information. Now, some defendants, not very many, represent themselves, and there's a provision in this act that if the court found that it was necessary to give this information to the defendant so that he could defend himself if he were unrepresented, then that could be done. We do have actually one suggested change to the bill as it's written. The definition of personal financial information essentially adopts the definition of personal identification in the identity theft statute, which is 165-800, and it's actually reprinted at the bottom part of this bill because this proposes to amend that statute also. And this would preclude, the way it's written, it would preclude giving photographs of victim or witnesses to the defendant, which would cause some problems, and particularly in assault cases, because frequently we were provided with pictures of the assault victim showing the injuries, and that is the kind of information that the defendant probably needs to see. So we would suggest that this be changed to add on line 21 and page 2 or a person's photograph.
Or what?
Or a person's photograph.
Okay. Thank
you. So how would it read if you did that?
It would read, personal financial information includes but is not limited to the information specified in ORS 165.800, parent 4, parent B, except that personal financial information does not include the name of a victim or a witness or a person's photograph.
Okay.
Section 2 of the statute, of the bill, would broaden the identity theft statute to include verbal representations, and this is covered in the written testimony, but just briefly to cover those instances where people call up a merchandiser that sends merchandise out over the phone, a catalog company or something like that, and claims to be a particular person and orders merchandise and is not that person.
Okay.
And this identity theft statute, the way it's written now, does not cover that.
All right. Thank you. Any questions, Mr. French? All right. Thank you.
Thanks.
Susan Russell. You are getting to be a fixture in this building.
Well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, apparently criminal bills seem to be set more likely on Tuesdays and Thursdays, which are the days that I cover this committee, so that's why you see my face so often.
Okay.
I just have some brief comments. Susan Russell on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association on Senate Bill 308. As I say, just some brief comments and concerns. First, with respect to the amendment of ORS 135815 in order limiting personal financial information, I wanted the committee to be aware that these provisions do have a fairly significant financial impact on defense providers. For example, the estimate has been from the public defender's office in Portland that as a result of this
Can you speak up, because I'm having a hard time.
Okay, sure. One of our concerns is financial implications of these restrictions on information, in that what normally happens is then we would get the police report as a part of discovery from the district attorney, and then the public defender would be required, or the defense attorney would be required, to redact the information, remove it, and then pass it on to the defendant. The estimate has been, as a result of this pre-existing law that says a number of information cannot, personal information cannot be included, the estimate has been that it's basically taken the work of 4.5 legal assistants at the public defender's office in Portland, and in Lane County, the public defender's office has estimated it's taken sort of two full-time legal assistants. So our concern here is by having additional information, and again, it's quite a bit of information that's going to lead to further financial costs for defense providers where already there are financial reductions that they're receiving. So that's one of our concerns. The second is in terms of the list of information that's considered to be personal financial information. I would agree with the proponent that putting back in the defendant's person's photograph is a good amendment, but I would also suggest that a person's date of birth should also be an exception. This bill would requires that not only the date of birth of the victim, but all witnesses be removed. And I think the date of birth, which is the age of a witness, can be very important in a case when a defendant, in a case where there's numerous witnesses, is trying to work with defense counsel in determining whether the witness was there. So knowing the age of witness can be, or the victim can be, a critical matter in terms of preparing. And I don't think that a date of birth alone is sort of goes to the big financial concern in terms of the use for identity theft. So that would be a proposed.
Well, Susan, I can see where date of birth might be important, where age difference is a defense in a sex crime. But I don't understand the other discussion about the date of birth being germane to the witnesses, and I don't quite get that part.
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess my point would be certainly in that kind of case, in an age defense, it would be. But I think in also cases where it's determining how old is a witness, and let's say, for example, a date of birth would indicate that someone was 70, and it may be relevant the defendant can say that, you know, nobody. I mean, it may be an issue where knowing the age of a witness would help the defendant in being able to assist an attorney in discussing what the person's role or relevance or positions of observations would be. I think that my experience has been that knowing those kind of details about a witness can be important in trying to work with the defendant. who doesn't see the witnesses until trial and has to go on the police reports in terms of figuring out sometimes who witnesses are when they don't know the witness. It's not someone that they've ever had contact with other than perhaps the incident that led to the charge.
Okay. But in felony cases, don't you usually have investigators that talk to the various witnesses,
Mr. Chair,
independently?
Certainly. Certainly. But it's just in terms of the defendant being able to aid and assist in his defense or her defense.
I'm not sure I understand that part of your argument, but we'll let it go for now. Anybody else have a Senator Ringo?
Do you have any opposition to the change proposed under Section 2?
And Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, I was just going to get on to that. And we are concerned with that. And I think this committee visited the aggravated identity theft earlier in the session. And our concern, we're pleased to see that the intent to defraud is here, and it's not an intent to deceive or defraud. I think, as you may remember, one of our big concerns before is that the intent to deceive didn't require any fraudulent intent or desire to hurt the victim. And so we're pleased to see that language. Our concern here is passing on piecemeal amendments when there are other, amendments to the identity theft out there. For example, just dealing with this issue, we can see that there is a concern, I think the example that was given of this catalog phone order theft. But as you may recall, the aggravated identity theft would include, I believe it was someone who had committed identity theft 10 times within, I think it was a 6-month period of time. And of course, our concern of considering this provision in isolation from the other legislation or proposed amendments of the identity theft statute that are out there is that you could have someone, for example, that commits sort of a less aggravated identity theft under that proposed piece of legislation by simply doing a verbal deception on the phone, receiving minimal amount of merchandise, and facing 16 to 18 months in prison with no criminal record. So our position, I guess, to the committee is to suggest that the matters be all looked together, and I think there are other identity theft statute amendments that are still yet to be heard, and that it's difficult to appraise matters when they're coming piecemeal because it may end up with a consequence in other aspects that could be troubling or of concern.
Right. I think that's good counsel, actually. It's Chair's intent to try to bring these things together as much as we possibly can, although we've been through some of them, then we get new bills introduced, and so then we catch up with all the public hearings. But it would be my intent to try to bring these things together so the committee's got a better picture of the whole of the statute before we start moving those out. We're not going to be perfect, but we'll try to do that as much as we can. Okay, any other testimony?
That's it.
All right, counsel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Susan, I wanted to follow up on your comments about the fiscal impact and the legislative assistance at the defense attorney's office. Isn't Section 1-2A applicable only when there's not an attorney, an unrepresented defendant?
Mr. Chair, counsel, Section 2A, your question is it applies whether or not a defendant is represented by counsel. That's correct. Is that the question?
I'm saying doesn't on line 25 of the bill, doesn't that's that's Section 2A of ORS 135.815. It says if a defendant is not represented by a lawyer. So doesn't it only apply to pro se defendants? I'm unclear on that.
Okay. Mr. Chair, counsel, my reading of this bill is that it is the responsibility of the defense counsel to redact the information, and when the defendant is not represented by counsel, then the district attorney needs to fulfill this. And so
we
have obviously no costs when the defendant is not represented. Our costs are when we're representing. And it is a surprising impact. I mean, these reports can sometimes be hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pages. And, you know, when we're talking about, you know, for example, maybe this is something more on the date of birth, it may be a matter that appears on every page of the report and requires sort of a significant amount of time of whiting out every, you know, possible indication of those matters. So,
thank you.
All right, and even if this bill became law, what would be the penalty for violating it? Mr. French, do you have an answer to that? What would be the penalty for violating this law?
Mr. Chairman,
contempt.
Okay.
All right, thank you.
And, Mr. Chair, that's my understanding as well. I don't think that's ever been an issue, but...
All right, great. Thank you, Susan. And Ms. Christian, you're next up. Are you ready?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Very briefly, I'm Ann Christian. I'm here on behalf of both the Oregon Judicial Department and the Public Defense Services Commission on Senate Bill 308, and neither of those entities takes a position with regard to Senate Bill 308. There is concern that has been expressed by judges with regard to Section 2 and the potential fiscal impact, and I think that the chair's suggestion that maybe identity theft bills all be treated together perhaps in one hearing would assist the Judicial Department and also the Commission in coming up with an overall fiscal impact. I know that Mr. Lemon indicated that that was an issue that the Criminal Justice Commission was struggling with a little bit as well. So I think that's a good approach. With regard to Section 1, we received a number of comments from judges out there who deal with these issues every day as opposed to those of us who sit here in Salem. And some of the initial responses from the judges with regard to the fiscal impact to defense counsel that Ms. Russell raised was that the district attorneys would be responsible for providing the redacted police reports. And I do believe, based on the testimony and outcome of the existing provision that passed in 1999, which requires that a defense attorney not disclose the address and telephone number of victims and witnesses to their client, that based upon that experience and the experience since that law was passed, that the district attorneys will not be in a position to provide essentially two copies of discovery to defense counsel, one that is complete and one that is redacted. And so the assumption does need to be made that there will be some fiscal impact on defense counsel. And in 1999, we put together a fiscal impact statement with regard to those original provisions, not disclosing the address and phone number. And bottom line is that there was no additional funding, which is fine, for that added impact. Since then, we have had some experience, at least reported, and this is all I can say from defense counsel with regard to the impact of making up these revised or redacted police reports for their clients to review. And as Ms. Russell testified, I'm being told that at least for our two largest public defenders, it would be a grand total of six additional paralegals. Now, those two largest public defenders represent about 40% of our criminal indigent defense caseload. But what I'm here to just indicate to you is based upon in Metropolitan Public Defender, which was referenced by Ms. Russell, is the public defender in Portland, and looking at salaries for different public defenders. We have 10 in the state salary levels for paralegals. Theirs are one, the lowest, quite frankly, and at $20,000 per year, I would just suggest that there might be a fiscal impact if, even on a statewide basis, there was even an impact of one paralegal, or 20,000.
Hang on just a second. I deal with police reports a lot.
Yes.
And I'm assuming that defense attorneys actually read the reports.
Mr. Chair, I certainly think they do.
Yes, and I mean, the way I do in my job, if I get a police report that's assigned to me as a case, I'll make a copy that's my working copy that I'll put my own notes on.
Mm.
And I read through that. Why would a defense attorney not be able to just simply make a copy of the report and as they read through it, deduct the information as they're reading it, the relevant parts, as opposed to giving it to a legal assistant? I mean, it sounds kind of cumbersome. And
oh, Mr. Chair, I agree with you that the defense attorney, as he or she is reading through, could, with a black marker, right, mark through.
Right. I mean, it seems rather simple because they're really the persons who are making the legal determination that this information cannot be supplied to the defendant.
And
so,
Mr. Chair, just to follow up on that thought, so I appreciate the help. So they would, the attorney would have two copies run, and as they're reading through their working copy, because at least I'm one to write all over something. If I have a working copy, I'm writing on it. And so they would be inking out on the second. And the point is to have defense attorneys doing that as well. There will be some fiscal impact, and all I would say is, you know, $50,000 is the level at which it goes to Ways and Means. I don't want to send this bill to Ways and Means,
yeah,
but I just do need to have the record made.
Right, and actually what we're trying to do here is not burden Ways and Means, so we are trying to get fiscal impacts so that we have kind of an aggregation of all of the bills. What we're trying not to do is send 20 bills down there that cost $50,000 and end up impacting the...
Mr. Chair, I'd join you in that effort.
All right. Okay. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Anybody else wishing to testify on Senate Bill 308? If not, we'll close the public hearing on 308. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 307. Mr. French, you are up again.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, for the record, Al French, appearing on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. And this Senate Bill 307 is a Oregon District Attorneys Association bill. And this bill is also divided into two parts. The bill generally addresses voluntary intoxication as it relates to criminal defenses. And the present law states that voluntary intoxication is not a defense, except that it can be introduced by the defendant when it's relevant to an element, to negate an element of a crime charge, which is really, in essence, one hand giving and the other hand taking away, because the culpable mental state is always an element of a crime, and I can't think of any other reason to offer evidence of intoxication other than to negate the culpable mental state. So, essentially, the statute as now written really doesn't say very much at all. The proposal of the District Attorneys Association is to change that law so that essentially intoxication is not a defense at all, voluntary intoxication, so that somebody cannot come into court and say, I was so drunk, I can't be held responsible, or so high, I can't be held responsible for what I was doing because I didn't know what I was doing because of my voluntary intoxication. This kind of a defense would most likely be raised in a crime which required a specific intent rather than a general intent, which means that the state would have to prove that the defendant specifically intended to do a particular act, like murder, where the state has to prove the defendant intended to kill somebody, burglary, where the state has to prove that the defendant intended to commit a crime inside the building that he was breaking into, or a sex offense where the state has to prove that the defendant had sexual intent to sexually arouse. And I have in the past seen these issues in all three of those kind of cases, most recently in sex offense cases where people were say they were so drunk when they molested somebody that they shouldn't be held responsible because they couldn't form an intent. The second part of this bill addresses the affirmative defense of guilty except for insanity. And one would think by reading ORS 161-125 that voluntary intoxication would not be something that could be raised under the guilt except for insanity statutes, except that the Supreme Court has differentiated between defenses and affirmative defenses, and this statute says that it's not a defense, and guilt except for insanity is an affirmative defense. So the Supreme Court has said this statute does not apply. Now, this particular proposal addresses the situation of drug-induced psychosis, and that is something that we are seeing more and more of, particularly with the astronomical rise in the use of methamphetamine. The extended use of large amounts of methamphetamine does actually create a temporary psychosis in some people. And I'm not a psychologist, and I'm not trying to tell you that I am, but I have handled a number of these cases where there's been psychological testimony and where I've had to do research into this, and there is such a thing as a drug-induced psychosis with methamphetamine and also, I believe, with cocaine, although we don't see cocaine too much in our neck of the woods. But I personally handled about a year ago a drug burglary, robbery, car theft, et cetera, et cetera, incident where a man was on a methamphetamine binge and went on a crime spree at the same time, and his defense was that he was suffering from methamphetamine-induced psychosis and should not be held responsible. I have a murder case where that's the same defense that is pending, and we just had a murder in Clackamas County a week ago where that is going to most likely be the defense. That case involves mushrooms rather than methamphetamine. One of the issues that is raised by allowing this defense is that these kinds of cases are very, very expensive both to prosecute and to defend. If you start talking about this mental offense, because it always involves the use of psychologists. And it costs, I can't speak to how much the indigent defense pays for their experts, but it costs the state approximately $750 just to have somebody examined, and it costs hundreds and hundreds of dollars to have somebody testify. I think in the burglary case that I referenced to, it cost the state $1,500 just for that one case. And the bill in this murder case that I have pending is going to be in the thousands for sure. And lastly, I submit most important, is what happens to people at the end of these cases is the disposition. If somebody is found guilty except for insanity, that's not a criminal conviction. There is a very lengthy and complicated statute or series of statutes that talk about disposition, but essentially the court sends most of the people who are in this situation, they get sent to the jurisdiction of the Psychiatric Security Review Board for a period up to the maximum time that they could be sentenced in prison, which for a Class A felony is 20 years, for murder it's life, goes down from there. And the Psychiatric Security Review Board is required to keep these people until they are no longer suffering from a mental disease and defect and no longer a danger to the community. And if you are suffering from drug-induced psychosis, essentially, once you dry out, you're cured. And so somebody could commit a murder, and if they successfully availed themselves of this defense, they would be sent down to the Psychiatric Security Review Board, and within a very short period of time, they would be released back into society because they no longer have a mental disease or defect, because drug-induced psychosis is temporary.
All right. Questions?
On Section 1 of the bill, with the intoxication not being a defense for forming intent, In these cases, when you're not able to prove intent because of intoxication, is there a lesser charge you can bring that is not dependent on intent?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, it depends on the circumstances, but the answer usually is no. Now, the way the statute is presently written, recklessness is exempted from intoxication, so that's not a defense now. So if the person was charged with murder, then they could be found guilty of manslaughter if the jury found that they were reckless instead of acting recklessly instead of intentionally. So under some circumstances, assault cases also, because there are reckless assaults as well. So you could be found guilty of lesser charges on some offenses, but other offenses like burglary or sex offenses, if you don't have intent, you're not guilty. So it's an acquittal. And under this section of the bill, we're not talking about PSRB. We're talking about if we can't prove an element, the defendant gets found not guilty. So,
Mr. Chairman, what kind of sex offenses would you? I mean, if someone molested, say someone raped a child, and they were intoxicated, so they proved they had the defense that they couldn't form intent. Are you saying that person goes scot free?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, if that were to be the case, yes, the person would go scot-free, but that situation probably would not arise because well, it possibly could, but not likely. It's more likely it would be seen in a sex abuse case rather than a rape case, because in a rape case, the state does not have to prove intent to sexually arouse, and in a sex abuse case, the state does.
I think if I'm getting the gist of this, this is just an argument that comes up on a frequent basis in court. I'm assuming if motions are trying to, I guess, exclude evidence or perhaps maybe get the judge to dismiss a charge or do something other than go to trial, basically taking up a lot of court time. Yes, no?
Mr. Chairman, no.
Okay.
What actually happens is that the state has to prove, in a criminal case, the state has to prove all the elements of this beyond a reasonable doubt. And so this comes up at trial, not pretrial. The defendant calls an expert saying that the defendant was so drunk that he couldn't form intent.
But wouldn't it come up if they made statements to the police also? Wouldn't they argue that those statements wouldn't be admissible because the person was intoxicated, didn't understand their rights?
Mr. Chairman, that argument does come up, but I don't think that this bill would address
it. This would not do that. Okay.
That argument does come up frequently.
All right. Okay. Other question, Senator Ringo.
Thank you. It seems to me that the level of intent is a really, really important factor in determining how serious the punishment we want to mete out. I mean, it's one of the most basic things that if you're driving down the road and you accidentally run somebody down and kill them, you're not charged. It's not murder. You could just be let go, you know. And if you intentionally do it, it's a life. It's a life in jail. It's a life sentence. I mean, isn't that distinction accurate? That the level of intent is. I mean, we go from negligence, recklessness, knowingly, intentional. But I mean, isn't that just fundamental to sentencing and how we analyze these cases?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ringo, that's correct as to homicide and assault cases, certainly.
Okay. it seems to me, I mean, you gave an example. I mean, somebody could come in as a defense that they're drunk, and therefore they didn't have the intent. I mean, then it just becomes a jury question, right? I mean, the jury is the one who's going to decide whether they were really so intoxicated that they didn't have the appropriate level of intent.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, that's correct, yes.
Okay.
Jury question.
And essentially, you don't even want the jury to be able to decide that. You want to take it away from the jury whether they ought to be able to conclude that somebody was so drunk that they didn't have the intent. You don't even want to let them get that question.
Senator, Mr. Chairman, Senator Ringo, essentially, I think the answer to your question is, the short answer is yes, But your example of hitting somebody with a car, I think, is not a particularly good one, because somebody who's drunk and driving and runs into somebody, we're not going to be able to prove intent anyway.
Right.
What I'm talking about is somebody who shoots somebody.
Okay, but
and says, excuse me.
I'm sorry. You go ahead. I don't mean
somebody who shoots somebody and then says, "I was so drunk that, you know, I don't remember what happened, and I couldn't have formed intent to kill him because I was so drunk that I couldn't form an intent."
Okay, Mr. Carragher, I think somewhere along the way we have to make a decision as to whether we tend to trust juries or not trust juries, and I think that's what the adversarial system is all about. And I know that the DAs would rather not have people putting forth those kinds of defenses because sometimes, I mean, they are hard to overcome. But to me, it makes a big difference. If a murder occurred, on the one hand, it may have been cold-blooded and premeditated, and there's all sorts of factors that really show a high level of intent. And that I think, really is a different nature of crime than somebody that had 2 six-packs followed by a bottle of tequila. And I think there is a real distinction there. Isn't there?
I'm going to throw my experience in as a sex crimes detective. It's very interesting how you do see patterns, and I can point to some actual cases where one defendant is serving like 25 years in penitentiary for rape. He had a history of raping.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at the cases, you pull up the stuff, the intoxication, drug addiction, these kind of issues always seem to play a role.
Mm-hmm.
In the three cases before the one that I actually got him to plead guilty to, he successfully beat the rap, basically. I'm not saying it's because of this. I'm just saying there's a pattern where intoxication plays a role in the activity. So I'm taking from what you're saying, Senator Ringo, that you're assuming this person just goes out and gets drunk and makes a really bad decision and shoots somebody or touches somebody in a way they shouldn't or whatever, and that's sort of a single incident. I guess what I'm adding to this is that sometimes when you look at these cases, you see patterns of behavior that lead up to their ultimate commission of a crime. And what I'm thinking was actually a very, very brutal rape situation. The guy was, he could have clearly come in and argued that I was so drunk I didn't know what I was doing, because he was drunk, clearly drunk.
Mr. Chair, I think Senator Burdick really hit the nail on the head when she asked about are there lesser included, because to me that really is an important factor. I mean, obviously you don't want to let the perpetrator go free. And somebody was a victim, and they need a sense of justice. And to the extent that there is a lesser included, like there is in murder, for example, then to me that's the way it should go. And if there isn't a possibility of that in other areas like sex crimes, then that is a problem.
Okay. All right. We have Susan who's going to come up here and share her views on this matter.
Mm.
We may or may not have hit on some of them, but in any event, I think the statute needs to be fixed because the word relevant to negative element of the crime charge sounds kind of maybe a lot. Seems like the word should be negate, but I didn't major in English. Anyway.
Susan Russell on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association in opposition of Senate Bill 307. And actually, I have quite a few views to share, and we are strongly opposed to this bill. In our opinion, Senate Bill 307 would simply basically eliminate the mental element in cases where a defendant has used drugs, controlled substance, or alcohol, or is dependent on drugs or controlled substances. It would essentially create strict liability by making the defendant's mental state irrelevant where a conscious objective or awareness of circumstances is part of the crime. Oregon law provides higher penalties depending on the state of mind of the defendant. Simply as Senator Ringo has already pointed out by his example, a defendant who acts recklessly is deemed less culpable than a defendant who acts intentionally. To give an example, I put in my written testimony, a defendant who swings a bat to hit a ball in a very crowded area, not looking around or paying any attention to the fact that people are within a very short distance and hit someone and causes serious injury, is considered less culpable by law than someone who purposely decides to hit someone with a bat in order to cause serious injury. Under Senate Bill 307, such distinctions would no longer be relevant where the defendant voluntarily consumes drugs, alcohol, or a controlled substance. Drugs include, this is a definition I'm taking from the Oregon Criminal Code, substances intended for use in the diagnosis, cure, mitigation, treatment, or prevention of disease in humans. They include over-the-counter medications, aspirin, antihistamines, cold medicine. They include prescription drugs, insulin, antidepressants, sleeping pills, painkillers, medications for blood pressure, heart disease, or anxiety. Senate Bill 307 draws no distinctions between legal and illegal substance. It includes drugs and controlled substance in its definitions. We've seen a number of problems recently with the overprescription, I would say, of Paxil to juveniles, and it has a number of unintended consequences in terms of altering their behavior. That would be relevant under Senate Bill 307. Drugs and alcohol can also combine with a mental disease or defect in terms of whether in terms of affecting the defendant's criminal awareness or conscious objective. We refer to them as dual diagnosis, and many, many defendants will have both a drug addiction and a serious mental disease or defect, such as schizophrenia. Under Senate Bill 307, to the extent that the defendant's ability to perceive is affected by drugs, it could be prescription drugs for the mental disease or defect, or their voluntary use of illegal drugs, that would not be admissible. The defendant's mental illness would be admissible, the schizophrenia. Rather than this being a cost-saving provision, I would anticipate that it would be an extremely expensive provision, because I think that matter is going to be litigated by both parties. Was someone unaware of circumstances because they were a schizophrenic or because they were abusing illegal drugs or they were not following their prescription for their legal drugs? Those kind of matters, I think, would be hugely time-consuming, and as I say, I believe they would require experts to be hired on both sides and would be litigated.
Aren't they already litigated, though?
Mr. Chair, in many of these cases, in some cases, issues such as this are presented to a jury or a court if it's a court trial. And it may be that the defendant simply says, I was drunk. And the testimony may be no more than that, or there may be some testimony, lay testimony, about the level of intoxication or the effects of drugs or controlled substances. There are cases at present where experts are called, but I would say that where an alcohol or controlled substance a non-legal drug is involved, for the most part, and when that issue comes up at trials, there are not experts. I think that matter is simply often would come in simply by the defendant's testimony and may be discounted by everyone immediately. So I do think that there's going to be a significant rise. And this would now be a pretrial issue. And I think that it would be litigated in a separate hearing pretrial, because it would be a determination the court must find in terms of whether the testimony is going to be admissible.
But you guys do that stuff all the time anyway.
Mr. Chair, we do a lot of pretrial motions on other matters, but this issue is not a pretrial issue. I think that, as the proponent said, that this is a matter that actually is presented at trial.
Right, but it'd just be another thing you add to the pretrial motions to exclude evidence and such.
I mean,
in a criminal court, you know, sitting on the stand last Friday, in fact, and just be another question that they might ask me, you know, did the defendant appear intoxicated? Was he drunk? What was your opinion? Blah, blah, blah. What did you even go back to over the statements he might have sent to me?
And Mr. Chair, I think that's correct. My only other, well, my that's not a concern, but I think the way that this would be different in that what we're talking about with these sort of dual diagnoses is really a medical issue. And so it's not simply lay person testimony when we're talking about retaining experts. That is really an expense for both parties.
Help me recall the criminal law issue or principle about, I remember this years ago, that you take your victims as they come. In other words, in a robbery, you go in to rob a store, you have a gun, you point it at the clerk, and the clerk drops dead of a heart attack in the middle of the robbery.
And
aren't you ultimately culpable for the death of that individual because you scared the guy to death or caused him to have a heart attack? And
Mr. Chair, I think that's called, it's referred to as the eggshell skull defendant concept, and that's sort of how it is presented as the
right.
eggshell skull, which means it is true, and that has
right.
been a matter of common law and has been, and really is that
right.
The defendant doesn't, the defendant suffers and also profits, I would say, from the way that the victim is found.
Right.
That is
it's
to say, a vulnerable, a victim that has a medical
right.
problem.
Right. And one I use often because I get in this discussion with some of the pro-life groups with respect to civil disobedience, and I use the example of someone who chooses to set fire to an abortion clinic might intend to damage the structure of the building to prevent the furtherance of something that they object to. But if, in fact, a person was inside the building and subsequently died as a result of the fire, it's no less murder, even though they had no specific intent to kill that person. Is that not right?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. But I think the difference there is that the defendant has an intent to engage in conduct.
This is what I'm getting to. They did not have an intent to kill the person. They had an intent to do one thing, and there was a different result. And that's why I'm getting this criminal law principle of you take your victims as they come. And I'm bringing that back to someone voluntarily drinks or uses drugs to the extent that they do not now have the classical sense of I'm going to choose to do the following. Mm-hmm. Doesn't it fit into that same theory that now you have to take your victims as they come because you now are less in control of yourself than you would have otherwise been?
Mr. Chair, no, I think that is really different because in one situation, a defendant intends a behavior that has consequences. And so the defendant intends to do an act that has an unexpected result is different than a defendant who has, in some situations, no intention to do anything
okay.
or even an awareness of what
then,
they are doing. And so there's
argument.
A different
but
culpability.
Wouldn't it be reasonable to expect that a person who drinks to the point of intoxication or significant drunkenness, that they would reasonably know that their actions could result in some kind of injury or potentially death driving a car while you're...
And Mr. Chair, I completely agree, and that's why these defenses, to the extent we refer to them as defenses, don't work and do not succeed when we're talking about those kind of situations. Because the juries and courts are extremely unwilling to excuse criminal conduct because the defendant's simply saying, well, I was too drunk...
Oh.
or too stoned, or I...
But that's
you know.
I guess that's the point I'm trying to get to here in the construct that the District Attorney's Association has brought. If these defenses are not successful, then why would we have the argument made in the first place in the courts? Where would it be relevant, and where would it apply that the courts would accept voluntary intoxication as a defense to an element of a crime charged?
And Mr. Chair, I've given four examples that I was just going to go on to in
okay,
my testimony,
right.
and so... Leaving those aside, because I think we have the one case where it's presented usually without expert testimony through lay witnesses where the defendant is simply saying, I'm not responsible because I was drunk. And those don't fly. But there are, and the reason they don't fly is because all the circumstances speak contrary. So we have a situation where a defendant, because the law does not exclude someone whose inhibitions or prohibitions are reduced because they are intoxicated. So I'll give you a classic example, which is I think happens with a certain regularity, where you have the defendant, let's say it's a male, who says, when I'm sober, I never beat my wife, and is arrested on domestic violence on a number of occasions, and he's always intoxicated. But the circumstances will show in these cases, and to my experience, they always have when I've ever had a case of that nature, that the defendant was aware of what they were doing, and it may have been that the use of alcohol contributed to some problem the defendant had, and that, in fact, he didn't beat his wife ever when he was sober, but did when he was drunk. It doesn't excuse his conduct, and he is guilty of whatever assault he is charged with because he knew what he was doing and was aware of the circumstances. So the examples that I have given, which this law, in my opinion, would affect, meaning that there is a defense, a legitimate defense, and there would not be, would be the following. Let's say a defendant who, let's say he doesn't drink in general and goes to a stag party and drinks too much, and the defendant comes home and lives in a row of townhouses or houses that are very sort of similar, you know, one to the next. The next door neighbor's house looks exactly like his. It's unlocked, and the defendant goes into that residence. Was the defendant's intent to commit burglary? Is he guilty of burglary, or was the defendant drunk to the extent that he didn't realize he wasn't in his in the right residence? That would be an example. Another example.
Yes, Senator Ringham.
Just to interject, I'm sorry, but I mean, again, this is a jury question, right? I mean, you can be charged with anything, but why? What's wrong with letting the jury decide?
And, Mr. Chair, Senator, that's exactly our point, is that what the law does right now, and as I just said, the juries reject these issues overwhelmingly, where it's a simple matter of just, you know, I drank too much, I didn't know what was going on.
Senator Ringo, my comment while you're out of the room was that if these defenses don't work, then why do we have it in the law, and why do we argue in the first place? And I think you've given us one example of a person who did not intend to commit burglary because the townhouse looks like his own townhouse.
Yeah.
We actually had a situation in Portland where an officer dropped a guy off at his, and the place he said was his house, it wasn't his house. He went up and started beating on the door, and he got shot by the homeowner. That was a bad situation. Pretty bad. I think Portland got sued.
That would be relevant to
what? Yeah, it's just one of these things that comes to mind. It's like, you know, make sure if you're going to drop somebody off, they actually live where they say they're living. So. Susan.
Mr. Chair, give another example. Let's say a defendant, here's another crime that's a specific intent. Theft requires a specific intent. Let's say a defendant goes out to a restaurant, and let's say the defendant's eaten at the restaurant many times before and has always paid his bill. The defendant drinks too much on this occasion. He's not the driver, and he walks out without paying the bill. Did the defendant intend to commit theft of services, or was he simply intoxicated and didn't realize that he hadn't paid the bill? This bill, because it includes legal drugs and prescription drugs as well, would make this the following potentially exposed to criminal prosecution, where at present they are not, and that is that a defendant is in an insulin reaction, is a diabetic, and strikes an emergency medical technician and causes serious physical injury. The defendant has no recollection at all of the emergency medical technician. Under this amendment, Senate Bill 307, she could be charged with assault. I'm not saying that she would be, but she could be. Let's say a defendant is placed on an antidepressant and has a bad reaction to the antidepressant, and in the process of which she breaks her roommate's lamp but doesn't remember doing so. She could be charged with criminal mischief. So those are some examples of situations where there may be something that's going on either through a prescription drug or a medical reaction to a drug or use of an intoxicant where the person is less culpable. And, in fact, it's very relevant to figure out what the person was doing. How else would we figure out what the person's objective was if we completely made a ban and said that the jury wasn't to know or consider that? The defendant has a constitutional right to testify, and there is a concern on our part that Senate Bill 307 would be unconstitutional to the extent that it basically makes the defendant's state of mind under any of these circumstances immaterial. If the defendant's state of mind is immaterial, then the defendant could not testify about his or her state of mind. And I believe that it's open to a constitutional challenge in terms of it infringing the defendant's right, constitutional right to testify. As I said before, it's not a defense where alcohol, drugs, or a controlled substance simply reduce one's inhibitions. In other areas of law, I would point out that we do consider issues such as voluntary intoxication as a factor that makes someone more vulnerable and less responsible. And I'll give an example, and I don't mean to belittle this or take it out of context, but It is a crime, sex abuse in the first degree, for a defendant to have sexual contact with a victim who is, in the words, are mentally incapacitated. And that can be from voluntary intoxication and the use of controlled substances. And by law, in those circumstances, the victim is deemed incapable of consenting to sexual contact. And the defendant is put in a position of being responsible. And I'm not saying that that's a bad principle, but what I'm saying is that the law recognizes voluntary intoxication in other contexts as being a condition that reduces somebody's ability, and here, in that situation example, ability to form an intent and to consent. And so we do recognize voluntary use of drugs and alcohol as a matter that does affect people's mental states in other situations. At present, and I think this has already been discussed, drugs and alcohol are not a defense and cannot be considered when we're talking about reckless crime. And I believe that that has come originally from common law principles, with the idea being that by using alcohol or drugs, someone is engaging in reckless behavior, and therefore it is legitimate to convict them of a reckless crime. With respect to the second matter, which is Senate Bill 307 would also amend the guilty except insane statute. And again, we have serious concerns because it not only includes a situation where somebody is, and I think the example was used of a drug abuse psychosis, but it also would exclude people that have long-term brain damage or a mental disease or defect from prior use of both legal and illegal drugs and intoxication. So, for example, if somebody had had a drug abuse as a teenager, let's say, and had, you know, irreparable brain damage or an injury, Senate Bill 307 would exclude that person from a guilty except insane consideration. They would not be eligible, and information about their mental state would be excluded because it's not limited to sort of a present moment. It's any mental disease or defect that was caused by voluntary use of drugs or controlled substance or intoxicants would be excluded. And again, in these kind of cases, when we're talking about people that are insane, or because of a mental disease or defect, there often is the issue of what we call, again, the dual diagnosis, in that they may have drug and alcohol abuse issues, but they may also be schizophrenic. And most mentally ill people that are in the criminal justice system self-medicate, and the word's been used in the profession, by using and abusing drugs.
Okay. Let me ask you another question. Have you guys argued the issue of voluntary versus involuntary, y'all, in the defense bar? In other words, even if he's changed this and it was voluntary, couldn't you argue it was involuntary because the person's addicted, that they're a drug addict? Or don't you now? Because we use the term voluntary intoxication in the statute now.
And Mr. Chair, I mean, the argument would say that it wasn't a voluntary decision,
right,
to become intoxicated?
Right. In other words, the defendant is an addict. They're an alcoholic. They can't resist drinking, and therefore it's not voluntary.
And
is that argument ever made? Or it's probably not bought often, I suppose. Maybe it's just too ridiculous.
And, Mr. Chair, perhaps you should have pursued a career in criminal defense.
I've been on the other side trying to refute this kind of thing. That's why I ask future defendants certain questions, like, you know, what did you intend? What were you trying to do? And then when they say, well, I was going to beat the living snot out of her because I thought she was a blah, 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 then those are... Those are relevant statements.
Mr. Chair, my interpretation of these voluntary as opposed to is when it's voluntary and that you've made a decision to use,
right,
as opposed to somebody who spiked your drink at a party. But
okay, hang on. I got another suggestion here because I see this bill kind of spiraling out of control. But I want to ask you another question and ask Mr. French this. If you, on line 9, where the language is being deleted, included a word like materially relevant, or, and I'm not sure, material evidence. Put the word in that says it has to be material as opposed to just relevant, materially relevant. Does that make sense? I mean, it raises it up a little bit so that it actually has to have, at least according, well, I'm looking at the definition in Black's Law Dictionary of material evidence that says the material evidence is evidence which is material to the question and controversy and which must necessarily enter into the consideration of the controversy and is determinative.
Mm-hmm.
in the case, and it's the end of the, you know, it's determinative. So mm-hmm. I'm looking at, is there a way to restructure this so that the argument doesn't just come up willy-nilly mm-hmm. on a regular basis, but that it actually has to have some reasonable nexus to the defense, as opposed to, I think the original discussion that Mr. French had was that we have some circular language here where mm-hmm. it can't be brought up, but yet it can, and mm-hmm. it's entered into fairly easily.
Mm-hmm. And, Mr. Chair, I think that kind of amendment would be certainly preferable to what Senate Bill 307 is doing. And I think at present there isn't a pretrial determination. And I think that, you know, arguably under some, you know, higher standard or material, then, you know, it could be the basis potentially for a pretrial determination. But I would certainly say that kind of approach, you know, is preferable to simply saying that no matter what the circumstances, under any, you know, hypothetical, it is completely and absolutely by law immaterial.
Yeah. Okay. Well, just my little cut at this. Mm-hmm. Do you have more testimony?
I have one final matter in terms of just on the guilty acceptance saying the insanity defense, and I just want to point out two other things. One is, I think if you were going to find a body that is perhaps most frustrated with having to deal with people that really are insane, people that are really seriously mentally ill, or have a mental disease or defect, I think you would find people that work in the prison, because the prisons really are not good places. They are terrible inmates. They are very difficult and very time-consuming. They do not need to be there. They should not be there, and we're not accommodated to handle them. They need to be in the state hospital. And by law, when somebody is found guilty except insane, they actually can be held longer than I think any, you know, matrix you could work out under the sentencing guidelines, because under Oregon law, where a defendant presents a substantial danger to others, let's say a schizophrenic who's self-medicating and using drugs and gets involved in violent behavior, who is found guilty except insane, could be held, let's say on a burglary, up to the maximum that the law allows, which is 20 years, and will be held in the state hospital as long as they present a substantial danger to others. And so I think that's certainly, when we're talking about those kind of cases, a much better place than the state prison system. And I just wanted the committee to be aware that there really is quite an ability to keep dangerous, mentally ill people in the state hospital.
Right, except for budget. I think our budget constrains us in that realm, so... But I think, good argument. Okay. Mr. French, do you want to come back up and talk about any of these things? Or I guess I'm kind of spinning around here out of control of my mind trying to figure out what we're trying to accomplish and where we go from here.
Mr. Chairman, in response to your reference to changing that particular line to say materially relevant, I understand where you're trying to go with that, and I think it's something that we could look at, but I don't think that is the exact way to go, because the word relevant is defined in the evidence code, has a specific meaning, has lots and lots of interpretation by the appellate courts, and mm-hmm. the material.
You could say material and relevant, but that may not get you there either.
I don't think that would get us there either, but off the top of my head, I can't think of a way to do this, but I think that it could be possible to come up with some language that would get us there. The only other thing that I would like to point out is that this proposed legislation actually is in two parts, and it really... Although both parts have to do with voluntary use of drugs, they are really independent ideas, and I think that they should be looked at separately. I do not have any argument with the last thing that Ms. Russell said about people who are schizophrenic being better placed in a state hospital than in the prison, but my concern is the people who are not schizophrenic, who are using drugs and are temporarily psychotic because of the use of drugs, or allegedly temporarily psychotic, and as soon as they stop using drugs, they're going to be cured. That's my concern.
Senator Ringo.
I mean, practically speaking, how does that defense fare in the courtroom? Do juries accept that defense, or do they kind of say, well, this is BS, I'm not letting this guy go?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ringo, practically speaking, as Ms. Russell said, these are not popular defenses to juries. I think they have a little bit more success in some court trials, mm-hmm. although they're not, to be honest, they're not horribly popular there. But and one reason is that a lot of them, in my opinion, are frivolous. They're just, I mean, somebody using drugs and they're trying to use that for an excuse. But there are the burglary case that I made reference to that I tried not too long ago. The defendant actually was, during the week or two that this series of events took place, exhibiting psychotic symptoms. I mean, and there is really drug-induced psychosis. I'm not talking about you know, just people acting goofy or being high. People get paranoid, they have hallucinations, and they have other psychotic symptoms. They lose touch with reality. But it goes away as soon as they stop using drugs. And it can, you know, depending on how badly they're addicted to it, maybe a couple months, 6 months, maybe a year or two, and then it's gone once they're dried out. And those are really the classifications of cases that concern me.
What would you think about restricting what you're trying to do to felony cases as opposed to misdemeanor? Because that seems to me where intent is.
Mr. Chairman, I don't really have any problem. These issues very seldom arise in misdemeanor cases. Logically, I don't know why we would want to do that, except unless there's some kind of a financial issue. If somebody gets found guilty except for insanity on misdemeanor cases, they don't usually go to the PSRB anyway because the maximum sentence is...
I was actually bucking back up from Section 1.
Section 1?
Yeah. That's what I was thinking.
Okay.
Well, I've had enough fun with this issue. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr.
Any other questions? There are none. We're going to close the public hearing and we're adjourned.